The Means Committee Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is Tuesday, April 19th, 2005. Today we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 5024, the Employment Department, and we're going to jump right in with some invited testimony on the background of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And we're going to ask the very good Representative Lane Shetterly, the now director of the Department of LCD, and Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner from Boley. And let's see here, Greg Malkasian. Is Greg here? Greg, come on up.
John.
Oh, perfect. John, come on up. Administrator for Workers' Comp Division. We appreciate the three of you coming before us. The reason we've asked you to come join us is we've had discussion about the Office of Administrative Hearings, and we're trying to find out the role they play relative to the other hearings offices that the legislature also funds. And so we appreciate the three of you being with us. The member who we primarily held this or brought this forward for will be with us very shortly, and so if he has any questions, we may ask that he will come track you down in the future. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Who would like to start?
I guess they're looking at me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lane Shetterly. Let's see, currently Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, formerly State Representative, and sponsor in 1997 of House Bill 2948, which was the first iteration of what became the bill to create the hearing officer panel. I say first iteration in recent history. I think legislative interest in a central panel for the conduct of contested case proceedings goes back at least 20 years before 1997. But in its most recent history, it really began with House Bill 2948, which passed the 1997 legislative session, was vetoed by Governor Kitzhaber. In his veto message, Governor Kitzhaber committed to work with me and other interested parties in the concept of a central panel. And so for the next 18 months, Chip Lazenby, who was the governor's legal counsel, and David Schumann, who then was deputy attorney general, and I worked with a panel of agency folks and some other private sector folks who had an interest in this, and created what became in the 1999 session House Bill 2525, which then created the Office of Administrative Hearings. It established it for a pilot phase of 4 years, and with an opportunity for review. That was done with a Joint Legislative Audit Committee audit of the panel, and in 2003, it was made permanent with House Bill 2526, and so that's what you have. I think one of the questions, as I understand from the subcommittee, was some of the thinking perhaps that went into the panel, and then how it was constructed, who was in and who was not. Speaking now with my former legislative hat on, and the legislative interest in the panel, was the sense of separating out the hearings function from the other administrative functions that are undertaken by agencies, so that at that point in time when you have a contested case between a citizen or a business entity that may be a regulated entity by a particular agency, that hearings function could be conducted in an environment that that sent a message of independence and fairness and impartiality. Not that, and that is not to indict the agency administrative hearings process prior to that, but that certainly was a perception anyway behind the legislative interest in the bill to create this separation, to provide for fairness, in fact, and some level of separation and independence in the conduct of a contested case hearing. That was the legislative underpinning of the policy behind this. We were not the first in the nation by any means. I think at the time Oregon established its panel, roughly 24 other states had already gone that route, and some states have done that since. So it continues to be a direction that states move in creating this separation of function when it comes to contested case hearings between state agencies and regulated parties. A little bit about how the bill came to be in terms of who was in and who was out. House Bill 2948, which was the 1997 version, started from the notion that we would build, you were out unless you were in. Basically, that was the policy or the philosophy behind the bill. So we listed agencies that would be included in this central panel. The thinking being that we knew that there would be budget impacts. We wanted to be careful not to make it too big to be unwieldy, and perhaps to not start off with something that might be unmanageable as a first time out of the gate affair. And so I think we probably, if you look at House Bill 2948, there were probably 15 or 20 agencies that were specifically called out and listed in the bill to create what we thought would be a critical mass to get some experience under our belts begin small and probably grow from that. That was the bill the governor vetoed. When the governor came on board and after the 18 months that we spent in the interim reworking the bill, the governor was the one who basically said, well, if it's good for a few, then let's call it good for everybody. And so the rationale really kind of flipped on its head, and for the purpose of House Bill 2525, which ultimately became law, you were considered in unless you were out. And so whereas 2948, the original version, said you're out unless you're in, 2525 comes along after the governor's work on this and says you are in the panel, you are included as an agency within the panel unless you are excluded. So then in building House Bill 2525, it became a matter of identifying who would be excluded from the coverage of the panel, that is, who would not be included. And if you look at House Bill 2525, it really breaks down into three main groups that were excluded from the central office, the Office of Administrative Hearings. First was the elected officials, governor, treasurer, secretary of state, secretary of superintendent of education, labor. The statewide elected officials were excluded as a group, and frankly, I don't recall much discussion about that. I think that was just where the governor was coming from, that we would leave out elected officials and the hearings functions that they had within their respective departments. But that's one group. The second group was what I would call the public safety agencies, corrections, youth authority. We did not want to burden this infant panel with the kind of hearings and issues that you get, prison cases, prisoners alleging the violation of rights, and the hearings that the Department of Corrections conducts. We certainly did not want to get involved in the business of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and those kind of agency functions. So public safety generally we carved out as a second category of exemptions. And then the third category was boards and commissions and departments that already had a pretty sophisticated and well-constructed statutory scheme that outlined the hearings process. In many cases, there was a whole body of law underneath some of these that was so different, so out of the ordinary, and also in many cases complex based on the history of these particular agencies, boards, and commissions, that again they were excluded. And that group would, I think, generally include Employment Relations Board, PUC. That was one that everybody said stay away from. Land Use Board of Appeals, LCDC, that also at the time was left out. They don't involve, those are hearings involving government to government as opposed to individual regulatory kinds of hearings, so they were considered a little bit different anyway. Department of Revenue was one good example of one that already had a magistrate division in the tax court that was something unique and of its own that we didn't want to reconstruct. Energy Facility Siting Council, no one could figure out what they do. So we didn't want them. And you know, that was it. It's not a real tight analysis there, but that was the general notion that you had. Some, and workers' comp, I was also in this category of ones that were just weird and already big enough and grown up that it would be very difficult, we thought, to bring them in. And also, I think there were some concerns as we were looking at this that once you change the analysis to the, you know, being in unless you're excluded, that all of a sudden made this panel very large right out of the gate. And moving these in would likely just add more weight and expense and complexity to a new central hearing officer panel, now known as the Office of Administrative Hearings. And that was another reason I think that they were left out. The last one, as a category by itself, I have no idea why they were not included, but that's the Boards of Stewards appointed by the Oregon Racing Commission. Got no idea why they were left out. Must have had a good lobbyist. I don't know. But other hearing functions of the Racing Commission, I understand, are in the panel, but for some reason the Board of Stewards. And that's it. That is, in a thumbnail sketch, the history of the panel and then the rationale that guided the creation of the panel and the inclusion or exclusion of various boards, commissions, and departments.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Shetterly? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lane, for coming today.
You bet. Good to nice to be in front of a subcommittee that's not mine. Not that I don't love my subcommittee.
You can flesh that out.
Yeah, it's just it's nice to be talking about somebody else's budget. I've done a lot of that.
In your judgment today, are there any hearings panels that should be included in the broad administrative hearing panels in the employment department?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, given my current appointment on the other side of the fence, I'll have to be very
circumspect.
Yeah, circumspect. I would say I'm not aware, at least until the day before I was appointed, I wasn't aware of any great change in circumstances that had affected at least the initial thinking and rationale that went into this. But frankly, that hadn't been a discussion that we'd had, whether or not any more should be at that point.
Follow-up? Any more questions for Lane? Thank you so much.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I've got to speak to a group downstairs. If I may.
Are we dismissing him?
Well, I'm asking if I may be excused.
Questions, because he's got this appointment. And
already? I'm just getting warmed up.
You'd be dismissed if you could leave really quickly before he gets going.
Before he gets the motion in? I do want to say, if I may, just in parting, what a great job the employment department has done in hosting the panel, the office, and Debbie Lincoln, I think, is to be commended for that. It was something that employment did not ask for. That was a budget decision to place it in employment as much as and logistics as well as to provide support. They've been an excellent host, and Tom Ewing, as the now the chief administrative law judge, has brought a passion and a commitment to the mission of the Office of Administrative Hearings that I think has been substantially responsible for the success that the panel has enjoyed. So, I just want to leave those.
Can we have this witness identify himself again? I mean, is you are Lane Shetterly?
Still, yes.
Trashing the committee that you normally testify before.
No, I mean, I love that on my committee. I love my committee. They're good to me.
Mr. Chair, all I can say is even being with the LCDC, he has not lost his gracious.
That's to the bone.
Or his acumen.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I find myself in an odd position as I was the Employment Department legislative liaison when this hearings panel, which I call the hearings panel, was formed, and so I had the pleasure of working with Representative Shetterly in forming the panel and working on that legislation, and then having the pleasure of sitting on a hiring panel to hire Mr. Ewing with Mr. Shetterly. So it's an interesting coincidence that I've been asked here today. At the Bureau of Labor, as Representative Shetterly, excuse me, Director Shetterly, I can't get rid of the representative title, has said, we at the Bureau fit in several categories. At that time, we were a statewide elected official, so as you've seen, all the other statewide elected officials had their hearings panels exempted out from the overall hearings panel. And in addition, we, I think, fit where Representative Shetterly also mentioned, where we had a well-formed, complex body of law and categories, a body of law with a lot of case law. We publish what are called BOLI orders, the BOLIOs. There's I think 20 of them now, 19 of them now. So we have a great deal of case law related to both our civil rights and wage and hour statutes and the interpretations by the ALJs. Our ALJs also help us publish these documents. So if we were to lose them to a panel, we would have to absorb that work elsewhere. And we do also a digest of all of our decisions for practitioners in the field of civil rights and wage and hour law so that they're available to them to also know what the kinds of decisions that the commissioner has made. We have a very lean and efficient hearings unit. Our legal policy advisor also wears the hat of the director of the hearings unit. In our case, the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor also signs the final order, so he is, at the end of the day, the arbiter or the judge as well, so in terms of signing the order. We have a great deal of confidence in our hearings procedure. We have a performance measure that we have 85% of our hearings orders held up on appeal, and we have been meeting that. So I think that's a good test in time about whether or not our hearings decisions are upheld at the Court of Appeals. So I don't know what else the committee was interested in terms of hearing today, but I was given those kind of assignments to sort of respond to those questions. If you have other specific questions, we'd be more than happy to answer them.
Okay, questions for Ms. Talbot? Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, and I'm pleased to be here today to speak to you about the Office of Administrative Hearings. As you've heard, there are several reasons why some boards and agencies were excluded, and I think there's several reasons why the contested cases and hearings that are heard in front of the Workers' Compensation Board were excluded. Probably the third area or main group that Director Shetterly mentioned matches the Workers' Compensation Board the best, which is it's a board that has a sophisticated and well-constructed statutory scheme and body of law. The body of law goes back to the teens, and about 1917, I think, were the first hearings that started in the workers' compensation arena. The Workers' Compensation Board provides an independent panel of administrative law judges who have expertise in this area of workers' compensation, which is very complex, very specific. Typical things that they are looking at are such things as compensability of the workers' compensation claim, which can turn on a lot of different issues, as well as things that get to be extremely important and specific, such as exclusive remedy cases. The most recent one that comes to mind was the Smothers case that required a Supreme Court decision a couple of years back, which was a very large and very important case for the workers' compensation arena. The board is the Workers' Compensation Board is designed to resolve these complex issues, and I want to note that many times there's multiple issues that are brought forward by the plaintiff in their request for the hearing, which is what triggers a case being set at the Workers' Compensation Board, of course. And having these claims routed to the board achieves a high degree of efficiency for the workers' compensation system, very much like the Bureau of Annette spoke about the Bureau of Labor. There's a high degree of regulatory streamlining and efficiency that is already achieved with the Workers' Compensation Board and the Workers' Compensation Division being able to work together. We share information systems. We share information technology, information resources. We make up what I would call a holistic system that approaches the workers' compensation issues together, and there's quite a bit of efficiency that's already there, and I think that would be at risk if we saw the appeals going to a different board. I want to emphasize that the Workers' Compensation Board is independent. It was set up in 1965 as an independent agency by the legislature, and in the 1987 session, the legislature reaffirmed its commitment at that time, that placing it as an independent agency inside what was then the Department of Insurance and Finance, which eventually morphed into Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'd be happy to answer any questions I can of the committee.
Any questions, Mr. Schultz? I think not. You've given us good information. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Appreciate this information on administrative hearings. We now will shift to budget detail. Debbie Lincoln, Greg Hickman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. Yesterday when we left off, we were about halfway through our budget detail discussion. So if it's all right with you, I'll just turn it over to Greg Hickman to pick up where we left off yesterday.
Okay, sounds good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Hickman. I'm deputy director of the Employment Department. We were starting to discuss yesterday the child care division. We had a lot of discussion about child care division up until then, but we want to go over the priorities, the outcomes, challenges, and our solutions for this next 2 years. Just briefly want to mention child care division supports Oregon families and businesses by planning, promoting, funding, and regulating a statewide child care system. They license more than 6,000 child care businesses. They investigate serious child care complaints, and they initiate and fund programs to improve quality and availability of child care throughout the state. The first priority of the child care division is to ensure the health and safety of children who are in child care. And the outcomes that the child care division looks for in this next 2 years is to assure that children do not become seriously injured or ill while in child care. The challenge, as Administrator Olson mentioned yesterday, that a large number of children are exempt from child care licensing and inspection. The solutions to meet this outcome are that all licensed child care providers receive on-site inspections for the health and safety, that we investigate all serious complaints that come to the division's attention. We track all injuries that require third-party medical attention, that all children who are in child care have updated immunization records on file, that we continue to do criminal background checks of all providers and members of households that are in those households who provide child care. And we continue our pilot to make mental health consultants available to providers. The second priority of child care is to promote high-quality child care. The outcome is for children to enter school ready to succeed, and the providers have access to training and education. Some of the challenges are that child care providers are among the lowest-paid professions in the state, and the training is often difficult to obtain in rural areas of Oregon. The solution is to continue to use federal funds to make training locally available. We provide training scholarships through local organizations for providers to continue to get that education. And we continue the program of matching new providers with those providers who are experienced in a mentorship capacity. The third priority of the Child Care Division is to promote affordable and accessible child care throughout Oregon. The outcomes are for working parents to be able to afford quality child care, for working families to find child care that's near where they live or where they work, and then also for working families to find child care during non-traditional business hours, also in rural Oregon, and for children with special needs. Some of the challenges are that low and moderate households often pay up to 30% of their income for child care, and that non-traditional child care hours, rural areas, special needs child care is often lacking throughout the state. Our solutions are to continue funding quality initiatives through the child care contribution tax credit, that we continue the Oregon Employment of Choice campaign, or Employer of Choice campaign, where we make businesses aware of the benefits of assisting their employees in finding their child care. Also, that we fund child care resource and referral agencies to provide information to parents, to recruit providers for non-traditional hours, and for serving children with special needs. And we continue our work with the Commission on Child Care and the Child Care Resource and Referral Network to find more rural Oregon child care. And then we also fund child care for special needs through contracts with the Oregon Developmental Disability Council as well. So that is an overview of our priorities and outcomes and challenges. Mr. Chair, if there are no questions, I'll go on to our next division.
Are there any questions?
The next division I'd like to discuss is the Office of Administrative Hearings. We heard much about this in the previous testimony. The mission of the Office of Administrative Hearings is to be an independent, impartial forum for citizens and businesses to adjudicate disputes with state agencies. We have mentioned before that 90% of all state-contested cases are adjudicated through the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that the Office of Administrative Hearings hears cases for over 75 agencies. The priority is to provide citizens with independent, impartial forum to litigate disputes with state agencies. The outcomes are that administrative law judges issue orders that are legally correct and outcome indifferent, and that it's cost-effective, efficient, and cost-effective. The challenge is training administrative law judges to achieve consistency in timely orders, and then also gaining the operational efficiencies to make it efficient. The solution is the Office of Administrative Hearings is experimenting with a mix of training tools for the administrative law judges, in-person training, online training, videotaped lectures are some of the things that they're experimenting with. Also, the regionalization of hearings is another effort to streamline and make hearings more efficient and effective. And the last solution is to develop and implement an automated case management system where we track the cases throughout all of the different hearings. That is a review of the Office of Administrative Hearings. Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions, I'll go on to our last division.
Any questions relating to administrative hearings? Senator Bridger.
Yes, looking at your pie chart, where you have 59% coming, is that from the Department of Education? It just shows how many cases that you've...
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that's Employment Department.
That's the Employment Department. So that's your participation in these agencies? I'm confused as what the chart means.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, this is unemployment insurance cases. So if a claimant feels like a decision went against them, they were denied benefits, or if an employer felt that a claimant who had worked for them was receiving benefits there, they had the chance to appeal those decisions. So this represents those decisions.
Okay, and so in that same pie chart, then the 17% with ODOT, 6,115 cases?
Mr. Chair, Senator Virginia, those are the implied consent hearings, the DUI cases that the... Yes.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions, I'll go on to our last division.
Okay.
Our last division is the Workforce Economic Research Division. You heard Graham Slater yesterday brief the committee. He's the administrator of our research division. And real briefly, WORD develops and distributes quality workforce information to promote informed decision-making. It's used by businesses, economic development, workforce investment boards, elected officials, and other policymakers, educators, students, parents, a variety of others who rely on this information. We receive many compliments in the department about the good work and the customer service of our research division. The priority of our research division is to calculate, analyze, and distribute workforce economic information that is essential to informed decision-making. The outcomes are to continue to provide information that includes unemployment rates, industry employment trends, occupational projections, things of that ilk. It's used, again, by various customers who need the information. Some of the challenges are to strive to meet customer demand as soon as possible while assuring the high quality of the information that the division tabulates. And a challenge also is to make sure that it has quality, that it's unbiased, that it's reliability, and that it's never compromised. And also, we are receiving increasing requests for local information. And using our geographic information systems on down to counties, zip codes, urban growth boundaries, things like that. The solutions for research are to continue introducing new data analysis, like geocoding, and to continue to be flexible and nimble in responding to customer needs. And that's a quick summary of the priorities and goals for our research division.
Okay, just a moment. Monica, I'm looking at FF1, which is the graph showing funding, and I'm not real clear what the history is on this because it shows no prior funding, so would you explain where this has been done in the past?
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Workforce and Economic Research Division was formerly part of their Business and Employment Services Division, and this biennium they were requesting to separate it out and present it in its own division. So its history on expenditures would be in that other division.
Are they broken out there so that we can see how the cost compares with?
Not within this detail, it is not.
Mr. Chairman, on page, I'm sorry to interrupt, but on page C1, the Business Employment Services Division's money is broken out, and there is a footnote that talks about it's not in a lot of detail that we can get more detail, but word was about 70 FTE and $12 million in the past. So if you'd like for us to break that out further, we can do that.
Has the FTEs changed since the last biennium, or is it carried forward?
Mr. Chairman, no, the FTEs have stayed flat.
Any questions relating to workforce economic research? I did notice when I was looking at the various data on administrative hearings that the cost for hearings coming down, the efficiency seems to be going up, that I mean, the graphs are looking really good. And that's what I want to congratulate you on how well that's going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ewing has done a wonderful job with that.
Thank you. Let's just spend a moment longer and look through and see if there's any questions that anybody has. Looks like your website utilization is going down. I'm on F5.
Mr. Chairman, we did notice that in March 05 had the highest number of hits ever. So it's a little hard to tell year to year, but it is a going back up again, I think.
Okay. Just wondering if there's been any major change in the website or something.
Mr. Chairman, we just think it keeps getting better.
Good. The utilization of that technology is wonderful. All right. See no questions. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
See if there's. We can now. Do you have any other things?
Mr. Chairman, just one more. We did give you in front of you answers to the questions from yesterday. We'll let you take a look at them at your leisure and respond to anything else anybody wants to. And other than that, we are finished.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate the information you provided for us today.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, can I go off in a wild direction?
I was looking at the chart that you provided in the answers to the questions that were at our place today, and I was specifically looking at the Oregon child care infrastructure. And I didn't do you the courtesy of telling you I was going to ask this, so I didn't think of it until just this second, and I'm going to ask you to just speculate with me for a moment. We heard a lot of testimony last night, all of us that were on this panel, we heard a lot of testimony about the Commission on Children and Families. And I was frankly quite surprised to learn in the amalgamation of this testimony that the Ways and Means Committee has heard as we've been on the road. I was quite surprised to hear the number of grants being made by the Commission on Children and Family to daycare providers and early intervention and prevention. And in looking at your graph and thinking about where we have children's issues scattered through state government, we have some in the Department of Human Services, some in the commission, clearly some here. Whether or not there's been any effort to take a sort of systematic look at where there's duplication, and what caused me to particularly think about it was that I hadn't thought of the Commission on Children and Families as a grant-making organization to 501c3s. And I presume that's what they are in order to receive the money. They wouldn't have to be necessarily. But these, I'm making the assumption, be private daycare providers that must have some degree of licensure through you. And I just need your help to understand that. It appears we've got money coming from a bunch of different places, oversight from one place. And help me just wander through the woods.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, members of the committee, good to see you again. The child care system in Oregon is really very collaborative and really quite well coordinated. The Commission for Children and Families is an important part of that system. They receive a fairly small amount of the monies that we contract to other state agencies and organizations for various purposes in the child care system. They receive about $3.7 million out of a total budget of about $120
million. Mr. Chair, with your...
Senator Johnson.
The 3.7...
I'm sorry, yes.
Comes from where?
It comes, and I'm sorry, for the record, I'm Tom Olson, Administrator of the Child Care Division. I'm sorry. The $3.7 million is federal funds that comes from the Federal Child Care and Development Fund, which is the source of over 90% of the child care funding available in the state of Oregon.
And then the whole pie for that is the $120 million?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the Child Care Division of the Employment Department is the lead agency for child care in the state. We're responsible for the money that comes into the state from the federal funding, and we're responsible to make sure that the...
May I interrupt you just so I can follow this? When you say child care, you specifically mean facilities that are taking care of kids while their parents are at work or at school? That's how you're using it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that's correct, yes.
Okay.
And so we are, as the administrative agency, we receive the money that comes from the federal government, and it's our responsibility then to work with a very diverse group of partners to design Oregon's child care system. And we're required every 2 years to submit a federal child care plan in order to get the money. And in order to do that, we meet together as a partnership. We meet every other month, and we have about 30 partners at the table. The Commission for the Children and Families is there, advocacy organizations, parents, every state agency that has a stake in child care is at the table. And as a group of stakeholders, we decide what the priorities are for the child care system in the state. And then we take those priorities to the Commission for Child Care, which is responsible for overall policy oversight and advice to the governor, and make sure that what's going on in the state is consistent with where they think the priorities and the policies should be. And as a group of partners, we then complete the child care plan, and that basically tells the federal government how we're going to be spending that money. And so you'll see, if you look at our federal plan, that you'll notice that there's that the Commission on Children and Families receives about $3 million of the funds per biennium. And the purpose of those funds is to provide some child care at the local level that's in accordance with the state commission plans. Unlike many other states, Oregon does have a commission system. Many states do not have that, and given the fact that we do have it, each of the commissions is responsible to do local planning, and one of the things they plan around is children and families issues. And the Child Care Commission has always received a certain amount of funding to give to those counties so that they can help carry out their plans and to keep them at the table for planning around child care. And
again, can I stop you just so I can follow this?
Sure.
So they're using this money, the $3.7 million that's divided among the counties and the commissions. Are they using that for planning, or are they using that in part for direct cash pass-throughs to providers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, planning is not a permissible activity with the federal funding. It has to go directly for program. In fact, we're required, the commissions are required, the commission and all of our partners are required to spend no more than 5% on administration. So any planning that's done with the money could be underneath, I suppose, the 5% administrative part, but 95% of the money has to be spent on program, and they do that in a number of ways. Each county, like I say, has their own priorities. Oregon's such a rural state, and it's difficult for some counties to get the proper amount of training. So some counties might use the money, and a lot of them do, to bring training into their counties so that the child care providers can receive their required training or training that they need to become more professional. Some counties choose to use it to allow someone who might want to go into child care to upgrade their facility so that they can maybe accommodate a wheelchair ramp or to buy toys for children if they're a low-income child care provider.
Mr. Chair, who oversees the fact that if a grant is given to a private provider to put a wheelchair ramp in, that the ramp got built?
That's the responsibility, Senator Johnson, of the commission. Now, the commission is, we contract with the commission, and then in turn the commission is required to monitor the counties and to make sure that the money is spent in accordance with how we design the contract. And we design our contracts as a performance-based system, so we try to give outcomes to the commission that the counties are supposed to meet, make sure that they know how the money should be spent, and then we rely upon the counties, the county state commission, to do the monitoring of their local county members.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Virgin?
Yes. Before we leave this, I'm just looking at all the exemptions under the licensees, the child care places that you license. And by the time I go through the exemptions, which is preschools,
mm-hmm.
educational programs
mm-hmm.
that offer 4 hours or less, okay?
Yep.
Fewer children than three, all on one family, babysitters, programs operated by school district. Of these 6,000 ones that you license, how many do you actually have to inspect?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, we actually inspect all 6,000 of those. The ones that are licensed are the ones that are not exempt. In other words, if there, we have about 6,000 licensed providers. Those are folks that that do not meet the exemptions. Oregon does have a lot of exemptions. There's no two ways about that. We are a fairly anti-regulatory state when it comes right down to it, and we have exempted a fair amount of child care. But we do inspect. We inspect every one of those 6,000 facilities that are licensed in the state
and
of Oregon.
Those are ones that are not exempt by any of others that I just read.
That's correct. They include family child care providers. Most of them are family child care providers. About 4,500 of them are small homes that can take up to 10 children in neighborhoods. And they provide a child care business for the people in their community. And, of course, there's the big ones, the centers like KinderCare and Learning Tree. You've seen those. There's about 1,000 that fall into that category. And then it's about another 250 to 300 that are larger family groups that are certified family, we call them, and they meet a higher training standard than family child care does.
Mr. Chairman, could I have a follow-up?
Certainly, Senator.
Do you require criminal background checks on people who work in the child care facilities that you are responsible for licensing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, yes. We have a very stringent background check process. We maintain a criminal history registry within the child care division, and everybody that works in child care or in early childhood education has to be in that registry. We have about 40,000 people in that registry, active in the registry. And they're in the registry for 2 years at a time, but every 4 months we run that database against the state police database to make sure that no one that's in there has offended in the last quarter. So that every quarter goes by, we go through and send out a lot of letters saying that you are no longer allowed to care for children in child care because we have information that you have got a founded protective service case or you've got an arrest for alcohol or drug abuse.
Probation and parole.
Probation and parole. Child protective services, we check it all. We also do FBI checks on anyone that's lived out of the state within the last 18 months.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in the budget document, child care, the last page F30. In the old 103 period, we had $2.7 million other funds and $1.9 million general fund. And then in the 0305 period, that kind of flip-flopped substantially, and the general fund went up to 3.4 and the other funds down to 653,000. What was the cause of that, and what's the source of other funds?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, part of that would have been reductions due to special session actions. The other funds primarily come from the licensing fees. I think there are some penalty money that is in there potentially, but primarily licensing fees in 2001-03 and 03-05. And the general fund reductions were backfilled with available one-time resources that they had. But that was flip-flopped back, as you said, in 03-05.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, let me also mention that we also are receiving the legislature in the last session passed the child care contribution tax credit. And we're authorized to sell $500 in tax credits every year and use that to for a pilot project to show how child care can work when you address parent costs, provider wages, and quality at the same in the same project. And that's $1 million, and that's part of that. The new other, part of the other funds is that $1 million.
Looks like, Mr. Chairman, about $1.5 million. The jump in general fund, and I assume that's the source of that tax credit, in general fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, it is in fact other funds, and we sell the tax credits for 75 cents in the dollar, so although even though we have $500,000 of them, we get $666,000 a year by selling them for 75 cents in the dollar. So the amount is more than the actual dollar for dollar amount if we sold them at a dollar for dollar. So we actually get more money into the program.
Okay. I'm not making myself clear.
I'm sorry.
There are two issues that I'm interested in. One is in the 0103 time period, the general fund was $1,946,000. The next period, it the adopted budget, it jumped to $3,426,000. The question is why that big jump? And then the second part of the question is the 0305 estimates of other funds are $707,000, and that's now jumping in the proposed budget of $2,289,000. And the question is why? Those are big swings. Why?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, I will get you some additional information on the specific special session actions that were taken in 0103. That's the first part of your question. What happened with, I believe, what happened with general fund between 0103 and 0305? You're going to see an exact reverse of the general fund support and the other fund support. As I mentioned, special session reductions were taken in general fund. Some of those were backfilled with available one-time other fund resources. I will get you the specifics on each of those reductions. But between 03 and so then when we moved into 0305, the general fund special session reductions that were taken and backfilled in 0103 were restored. So that's why you see the $1.9 million in general fund in 0103 going back up to $3.4 million in 0305. It was just a restoration of one-time special session reduction costs. Between 0305 and the 0507 budget is going in the other fund category is where you're going to see the increase in other funds that Tom Olson was talking about. It's the new tax credits that are being sold. So there's contributions coming into the division, and individuals are receiving a tax credit. The tax credit is not showing up here. The actual general fund impact of that tax credit would be on the revenue side, and that's in the revenue forecast. But these are the contributions that individuals are giving to the division, and then they're going to implement the pilot program that I think they talked about earlier. So I will get you the specific details after this meeting on each of those cuts that were made, but that's the general framework of why you see that big swing between the two biennials.
Follow-up. Is there a cap on the tax credits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, yes, there is. They're capped at $500,000 per year and for a five-year period.
Okay, thank you. That still wouldn't explain the huge increase.
I will get you further detail. Okay. I believe that it does, but I will get that to you and show you the numbers.
So it jumps from $707,000 to
$2.3 million. Senator Morris, yes, the $707,000 is what we estimate we take in licensing fees when child care providers renew their licenses. They pay us fees, $30 a year, and so that's where that comes from. Then we have on top of that $700,000, we have about $1.6 million in tax credits for the biennium for the $666,000 per year. So you add that to the $700,000 and you get the increase.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, let me take another shot at the child care tax credit. It was passed in 2001.
Yep.
So some of the for $500,000 a year in tax credit, but individuals make contributions to the division, they can get 75 cents on the dollar for their tax credit. So the tax credit is capped at $500,000 per year, which at 75 cents, I believe that equates to roughly $667,000 a year in possible donations to the division.
That's correct.
Then their expenditures, because of some implementation issues, they didn't start spending that money right away. So you have kind of a couple of years building up so that they're planning to start spending it in 05, 07. So it's $500 a year accumulates.
Should I have some additional questions on budgeting issues?
Okay.
While we're at it, I'm behind the last tab.
Are you in? Excuse me, Mr. Chair, in the presentation document or in the budget book? Okay.
The budget book.
And that tab is the special reports tab, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Looking at in the Orbitz narrative, page 2 of 19.
What page is he on?
2 of 19.
Tell me when you're ready.
I don't have an Orbitz narrative.
Here.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, federal funds, we're talking about revenue now, and
yes.
It says federal revenues, and I'm sure that it's just an accounting thing, but it says 03, 05 estimates, $358 million, 05, 07, it's $81 million. For other funds, the actual number is 0355, it's about four or five lines down from the top.
Oh, okay, I know where you are now, okay. We'll have to get back to you. I don't know what those non-limited funds are. That's
okay. On the bottom of that page, also says other revenue, other funds.
Yes.
And,
and there's a big drop there as well. Non-limited.
$3 to $15 million.
Okay. Let us get back to you. Our non-limited funds are almost entirely in unemployment insurance payments. So I'm thinking it has to be related to the unemployment insurance pot. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I can't answer those questions, but we will get back to you right away on that.
Take a note, there may be a couple others.
Yeah.
Now on page 10 of 19.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, Tom Barley, our UI administrator, says it's probably related to the reduction in federal extended benefits workload that we were paid for in this past biennium, but we don't expect to have in this coming biennium. because the economy is getting better. The federal government gives us funds to support workload, and since it's been so high, we've been getting an awful lot of federal funds. We expect it to drop off pretty substantially in 2005-2007. So I think that's what both of those items are. But again, we'll get back to you. Now you're on 10, I'm
not sure. Does that affect your employees, the number of?
Mr. Chair, it does. We've been managing that fairly well with limited duration temporaries. And again, as we moved our workload to call centers, we can manage workload with much fewer employees anyway. So through attrition, normal retirement, and the use of limited duration temporaries, and for a while some seasonals, we've been able to manage that workload.
So with this kind of a drop, I mean, if you're going to lose and go from $368 million worth of benefits to $15 million worth of benefits, assume that there will be a substantial net number reduction of your temporary positions?
If that, in fact, is what that is, and let us come back with detail on both the amount of money and the positions that are related to that, if there are positions with it.
Thank you.
Sorry.
10 of 19 talks about out-of-state travel, and you had budgeted for 0305 178,000 and 0507 382,000. So it's, you know, it's more than doubled. And so can you explain why it would be necessary to double your out-of-state travel?
Mr. Chairman, what we've done, if you look at the 0305 legislative adopted budget, it was at the $372,000 level. We have a great deal of required federal travel because we are a federal agency and it's a national program. We have tried very hard this past year to keep our travel down, so our estimates of actual are cut in half or a little more than half. When we developed the 0507 agency budget, we kept that line item at the same level we had put in the 0305 adopted budget, with the understanding that, again, we keep it down as much as possible, but we have at least the room to respond to the federal government and the national issues that that we need. So it's possible, it's probable that we would not top 200,000. If you look at 0103 and 0305, we were below 200,000. So that probably is higher than it would need to be.
And so would you respond to that and let us know what it really needs to be?
That we will, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
On the next page, 11 of 19, we have state governor service charges, and they're going up from $4.7 million to $5.8 million. Can you tell us why it would be over $1 million increase on biennium, 20%?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll ask Satish if he can answer that one.
Mr. Chair, Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. Actually, if you look at the 0305 legislatively adopted budget, the state government service charges are $9.2 million, and it's dropping to $5.8 million. That's the agency request. The way the state government service charges are developed are that, you know, there are a number of agencies like the Department of Administrative Services and other agencies like the Secretary of State. Their budgets are heard before in the General Government Subcommittee, and those subcommittees approve those agencies' budgets.
Yeah, and I assume, though, that we're not, that the last biennium has not been going into debt to the state, right? And we've been paying as we go?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are paying as we go.
Okay, so all we spent for 0305 is $4.7 million. And so if we paid our way and we're currently paid up and it's only going to be $4.7, why would it be $1 million more for the next?
Mr. Chair, we'd have to check on that, too.
Okay, if you do that.
On that, yes, we will.
Okay, thank you. And then at the bottom of that page, it says professional services. And in professional services, actually, we can go over to the top of the next page. All funds were at $9.6 million, and it goes down to $1.3
million. Mr. Chairman, that reflects our expenditures on putting together the UI service centers. We had to work with contractors and particularly with IT people to get those service centers up. So it was a substantial expenditure in this biennium, which we discussed with the 03 Budget Committee and reported to the Emergency Board on, and we obviously don't expect to have that level of expenditure this coming biennium.
there's no complaints. Just checking. I want to make sure you didn't make a mistake. And I hate to see you guys run short. Next page is 13 of 19. Again, we have a, you know, we have a drop. Your facilities maintenance is going down $100,000 or $50,000, and that's not normal. I guess it's just an efficiency.
Mr. Chair, yes, we. It's an efficiency, again, involved with move to the UI centers, and we hope either reduction or a flat budget for field offices.
Okay. My last question is related. We just skip way toward the back where we're going through the various picks, and I'm looking at, it says actually page 8, but it's they all look alike. I don't know how to identify the differences, but it basically is a breakdown of your personnel by classification.
Okay.
And it's three pages. It goes from page 6 to page 8. The very top left-hand corner says 11205 and then report number, and then it's PPDP. So.
Okay, I think we've got it. Thanks.
Okay. And it shows your classification, and it says that you have a total of 549 employees, position count. And 75 of them are in management. And so you've got a 1-to-6 staff ratio of managers to staff members. And that's substantially higher than what's required out in the private sector. And so I'm just wondering if you would also get back with us as to the need for that higher.
Mr. Chair, I think I've got someplace in here what our ratio is. It is higher than 1-to-6. It's more like 1-to-10. I'll have to get back to you and tell you why this particular chart is showing up that way.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? This is our last time to talk with these fine folks in our phase two. If there's anything else that we'd like to bring up now's the time. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a comment because I think we live in a little bit of a different world today, and going back to the child care issue, as a child growing up and then as a mother raising children, I don't remember being concerned about predators on my children. And today I worry about our children, not just mine or my grandchildren, but everybody's children, because of predators. And I would just ask you to do due diligence in your work, in being sure that we do not have people that should not be involved in these licensed places that you are responsible for, and that's just a comment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, as we've mentioned, it's our top priority, and it's our only life and death priority, and absolutely, we take it very, very seriously.
Other questions or comments? Okay. That completes this portion. Thank you very much for the information. And Satish, we now have Governor's recommended budget.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, this is Satish Upadhyaya with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be providing you with an overview of the Governor's recommended budget for the Oregon Employment Department. So if you will please refer to my presentation handout, which should be there in front of you. Okay, if you please turn to page 2. The charts on page 2 show you the governor's recommended budget for the entire economic and community development program area, which consists of 5 state agencies, including the employment department. The total budget for this program area consists of $5,326.4 million of total funds. This is about 13% of the total state budget. This program area also has $136.9 million of general fund and lottery funds, and this is a little over 1% of the total general fund and lottery fund state budget. With regards to the employment department's budget, it's about 32% of this program area's budget. There's only one program unit, that's the child care division, that has general fund, and it's about $3.6 million. Moving along to page 3. The Employment Department's various functions support the mission to support business and promote employment. And these functions support 2 out of the governor's 6 budget principles. And these are the principles relating to economic development and education and workforce development. Moving along to page 4, the chart on page 4 shows you the various fund types that make up this agency's budget. As you can see, the governor's recommended budget is $1,688 million of total funds. And you will also notice that non-limited other funds account for the largest portion of this budget. It's $1.33 billion. And these funds are used to pay benefits for unemployment insurance claimants. The second largest portion is federal funds. About 47% of the federal funds is for the child care division, and the remaining 53% for unemployment insurance, employment services, and research activities. The other funds support all the program units. Sources of the other funds, as you heard from the agency, are interest earnings from the state unemployment tax revenues before they are deposited with the U.S. Treasury, the READ Act funds that was talked about yesterday, the penalty and interest funds, and other revenues that the agency collects, like from contractual work. The general fund, it only funds the child care division. Moving along to page 5, the chart on page 5 shows you the various program units that make up this agency's budget. Among the limited program units, unemployment insurance is a little under 6% of the agency's budget, and they have 598.14 full-time equivalent positions. Business and Employment Services is about 5% of the agency budget, and they have 506.40 full-time equivalent positions. The Child Care Division, which is about a little over 7% of the budget, has 69.5 full-time equivalent positions. And the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is about 1% of the agency's budget, has 70.5 full-time equivalent positions. And again, the new program unit, the Workforce and Economic Research Program Unit, has 70.5 full-time equivalent positions. I'm sorry, the administrative hearings has 124 full-time equivalent positions. You caught that. Moving along to page 6. The chart on page 6 shows you the various expenditure categories. Personal services make about 10% of the agency's budget. Services and supplies, 4%. And capital outlay and debt service is less than 1%. The largest chunk is special payments, and of this, of course, the largest portion is the unemployment benefit payments. There's also special payments out of the child care division budget. Moving along to page 7. The chart on page, the table on page 7 shows you a comparison across biennia on the agency's budget. As you can see, in totality, the agency's budget is 32.2% less than the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget. Looking at the general fund, it's an increase of 4.7%, and these increases are just the standard inflationary increases. Other funds and federal funds, there is a decrease. And the reasons for the decrease mainly are phase-out of one-time fundings, like there was one-time funding for the telecom claims call centers, and there's also the reduction of funding for the Jobs Plus program, as well as the Groundfish Income Transition Program. And the huge decrease in the non-limited other funds is because of projected decrease in unemployment insurance payments to claimants. Moving on to the last page, the major policy issues. The governor's budget continues all existing programs. You will be seeing 3 policy packages. There's a policy package to make 2 limited duration revenue agent positions and 1 information systems positions permanent. These 3 positions were approved by the 2003 legislature as limited duration positions. These are to expand unemployment insurance fraud control efforts, and these are revenue generating positions. And it's expected that these positions will generate $2 million to $2.6 million in the next biennium. And the cost for this package is $362,334 other funds. The next package you will see is the continuation of 25 limited duration positions to work on unemployment-related grants and contracts. Now, the agency has always had this kind of a request before, and this is to work on any contract they get down the road to work on the employment related issues. Lastly, now you heard about the child care package. The child care package provides $1.5 million of other funds. And the background in this package is that the 2001 legislature approved the Oregon Child Care Contribution Tax Credit Program. And the 2003 legislature did some technical changes to implement the program. And this $1.5 million, most of this is going to be provided to other entities for child care issues. Do you have any questions?
Is that all the packages then?
That's all the packages.
No questions. It's about a $600 million reduction in benefits expected to be paid out in the next biennium as compared to the current biennium. These are numbers that I'm just not familiar with as far as the amount of money that is spent making payments. I mean, you just do the math, I'm sure it's all there, but huge amount of money, $1.4 billion in special payments that went out.
Yes, Mr. Chair, because of the recession and the huge unemployment rate in the state, unemployment payments, benefit payments really went up. And now the projection is that in the next biennium it's going to go down. So that's why you see also a reduction in positions.
Yeah, I saw that.
On that.
What are those positions? I mean, are they long, temporary, or are these full-time positions that are? Are these? Is this attrition? I mean, can you?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they're claims takers largely, and some adjudication staff. Reductions through attrition. Reductions through efficiencies with the move to the call centers, particularly. Reductions.
When you say moving to the call center, you mean the call center does intakes, and therefore that cuts back on the need for people to man individual locations, and therefore there's a.
Mr. Chairman, that's right. By moving to call centers, we were able to reduce the number of positions assigned to unemployment insurance by about 90. We reassigned a number of those positions to the Business Employment Services division to help businesses and to help those claimants get back to work. But the call centers are much more efficient than having UI spread out through all the offices, so we've been able to make some substantial efficiencies there.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, to try to follow along the lines of the ideas on staffing, I don't know if the agency is prepared to talk today, but they probably could talk to you about their mandated caseload. What you will see in this budget, as you see in the Department of Human Services, there is an 040 package called mandated caseload, which is part of the budgeting process for several of the agencies. It's that piece of their workload for which they have are outside, largely outside of their control. So yeah. When developing the budget...
Okay, who does the mandate? Is it DAS or is it federal or...
In this particular case, Mr. Chair, this is a federal program to do unemployment insurance. So in the process, in kicking off the budget development, the Office of Economic Analysis is doing their quarterly forecasts. This agency takes that quarterly forecast on where the economy is going to be, and they use a model that has been approved with the Federal Department of Labor on various different components, number of initial claims, duration of claims, number of hearings that they have to conduct, and they do a forecast of that workload based on that economic forecast for the state.
Has that caseload figure changed since we've gone to a call center model?
Mr. Chairman, the caseload number itself isn't dependent on how we manage claims. It's dependent on the economy and how many people are actually unemployed. So in the past biennium, we were up to 8.2% or 3% unemployment. That translated into hundreds of thousands of people who are applying for unemployment insurance. We're down to 6.3% unemployment now, so our need to pay out benefits and the number of people who are claiming benefits is much, much less. So that's how the caseload, our caseload is driven by the economy and by the number of jobs available and how many people qualify for unemployment insurance.
Has there been any staffing studies done in recent years to, as you have greater technology, more use of the internet, more use of telephones, more use of computers, It would seem that over time, one person would be able to handle more unemployed, you know, more clients than previously. And so while I understand that you have more, then you have more, but still it's a number of client versus employee factor that I'm asking if there's been any change in that regard in the last decade.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there has been. And as we developed our plans for the unemployment insurance call centers, we did quite a bit of that staffing analysis, and which is why we were able to reduce our UI staff by as many as we did. So we do have fairly specific numbers of claims per employee, per claims taker, per adjudicator, and so forth that we could show you if you were interested in seeing that.
Do you have access to how our ratio might compare with adjoining states' ratios?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we could get you that as well.
That'd be great because, you know, that now there's a benchmark and that, yeah, that helps show the efficiency.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
Anything else? Committee, we, if not, not objection, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.